I think all the best fashion, pop culture ideas comes off the street. It's not dictated by who runs the city or the millionaires. The best stuff's done by a kid in Moss Side or Absolutely. A kid in Burnage, you know. Yeah.
What did the Beatles do? They went to London. What did Motown do? It left Detroit for LA. What did Factory Records directors do? They put their money into the Hacienda and lost 18 million quid.
I just find it alarming that the woman who invented rock and roll, the distortion on the guitar, isn't recognised by this city. I think it's the biggest story that Manchester's sitting on that they just haven't celebrated.
I would say Manchester, when he faces up to the alpha cities, the big cities like London, it's like a chihuahua that's not scared of an Alsatian, isn't it?
Everyone, so I'm Vikas, and you're listening to the next episode of Foundations, recorded live here at Camfield in central Manchester, which is a next generation mega campus for technology and the creative industries. So, Foundations is a celebration of bold beginnings, brave ideas, and the people that make them possible. So, today we're going to be talking about the stories that made Manchester. And if we think about this building itself, you know, this was the site of Manchester's first public library, which was opened at a ceremony with Charles Dickens present. You know, after that, by 1800s, it became one of the city's most important buildings. It's had a lot of lives, like Andy here, which we'll come to. This building's been a Victorian super shed where traders sold cheese, flowers, vegetables and fish. In the First World War, it was a military workshop for artillery shells. In World War II, it housed barrage balloons that helped protect the city from the German air raids. So, yeah, this is not just a market hall. This has been a trading place, a civic space, a museum, and now it's a launch pad for some of the top technology businesses in the city. And that's why we thought it's a perfect place for today's panel. So let me just introduce you to our panelists. So we start with Lisa Morton, who's a true champion of Mancunian community spirit. So Lisa founded her PR firm, Roland Dransfield, in 1996, just 1 month after the IRA bomb in the city. She's the host of the We Built the City podcast, which you must check out, where she interviews icons from Andy Burnham to local heroes who've put their heart in modern Manchester. We have Karen Gabay, an award-winning TV producer, radio presenter and filmmaker, who's devoted her career to documenting Manchester's pop culture and untold histories. Her work ranges from preserving lesser-known histories of Manchester's migrant communities on film to curating exhibits about Manchester's entertainment heritage, including securing a blue plaque today, which is no mean feat for one of our real cultural icons. Exactly, more clapping. Thank you. I'm going to signal like this now whenever I need clapping. So for those on the podcast, I'm waving. Andy Spinoza, a veteran journalist turned author who's been embedded in Manchester's revolution since the 1970s. His recent book, Manchester Unspun, which you have to read, is very, very good. We went on a walk with Andy's dog before he published it. He sent me a Word document of the book saying, would you have a look at it? And I was politely surprised. It's excellent. In the book, he chronicles the city's resurrection over four decades, from post-industrial decline to cultural and economic rebirth. And it is actually a proper insider's view of how Manchester got made. We also have John Robb, who almost needs no introduction, a musician turned author who has lived Manchester's music history. He was an early stage post-punk pioneer as the frontman of The Membranes and later Goldblade. He's a prolific music journalist and founder of Louder Than War, documenting alternative music culture. He's also an author of several books, including The North Will Rise Again, and he's cemented his status as a chronicler of Manchester's music revolutions. So we're going to have a talk about Manchester's cultural, arts and technology heritage and how all of that mingles together. I've got some questions for the panel, but if you've got any questions, do pop your hand up. And if you shout, I'll repeat the question back for the podcast to make sure we keep it interactive. But I wanted to start with that question about stories. So Manchester has all these revolutionary, legendary stories, you know, political roots, music movements. In your opinion, is there a defining Manchester story that made the city what it is today? So I'll come to you first, Lisa.
Thanks, Vikas. Thanks for inviting me here. For me, the story that defines Manchester is in the mid-1800s, when Manchester was run on cotton. And back then, there was in the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln had decided that he wanted to end slavery. And even though the people of Manchester were dependent on cotton for their living, their livelihoods, they backed Abraham Lincoln and they signed an agreement in the Free Trade Hall to say that they wanted an end to slavery, even though the mills were closing, unemployment was rife and people were dying. And for me, that says everything about Manchester, that we choose justice over comfort.
I said that's wonderful. Andy?
My story's about the big building at the end of the road, the Beetham Tower, because I handled the PR launch of that building in 2007. It opened in 2008, and the media were absolutely fascinated by it because of the highest living space in the nation, and BBC actually scrambled a helicopter to do a live 6 o'clock news broadcast about it. But why is it so important? In right on the edge of a Victorian conservation area, the city council boss, Sir Howard Bernstein, fought off the lobby to not have any tall buildings in close to these old red brick historic areas. And because of that, Beetham Tower, it gave a template for the developers and the city to build lots more towers, as we can see today. Whether you like them or not, that was the pivot that has created the Manchester that we see today.
Brilliant. John?
Well, for me, it would be the 1976 Sex Pistols 2 gigs at the Free Trade Hall put on by Buzzcocks, which basically sparks the Manchester punk and post-punk revolution, where the whole music scene comes out of those like two iconic moments.
Yeah.
And it changed everything in the city. And I think not just music, but also culturally. And I think eventually the skyline, the whole thing about the city. So it went from being the world's first industrial city to the world's first post-industrial city.
Yeah.
And after the Pistols gigs, it became the world's first post-punk city.
Oh, fantastic. Karen?
One of them for me is the 1945 Pan-African Congress.
Yeah.
Manchester seems to be a place where people want to come and embrace and talk about culture and politics. And that fifth Pan-African Congress really led the way to many countries in the Caribbean, Africa, but also people in the city of Manchester becoming activists and taking that spirit on. There's a lot of the leaders from around the world wanted to create a new way of counteracting colonialism. And it's going to be, it's the 80th anniversary this year, and they are going to celebrate it with a play at the Royal Exchange, and it's about time,
oh,
I think,
fantastic.
That was done. Yeah.
If I can, so Karen and John, if I could just stay with you for a moment, because you know both of you have chronicled that essential role of music in the city. So it's not just entertainment, it's social history. You know, music's helped Manchester tackle some of those key issues, racism, youth identity, unemployment, and you know, perhaps even spark social change. And I wonder for both of you, what is it about Manchester in particular that's enabled it to do that? Because so many cities have got, you know, music and cultural heritage, but there's something about that intersection between culture and politics, and it creates change here.
Something that one of the Buzzcocks said to me, and I thought it's something that's happened throughout our lifetimes, what we forget about, is that Manchester always encouraged people to embrace music, but also to read books. We are in the space of a library. And I think that the Mancunians, who I know have created wonderful music, are great lyricists, and they seem to have read really well, and read, you know, anything from philosophy to, you know, just even the history books that were given to them by their parents. And they seem to be able to capture that and put it into lyrics that really have gone beyond the city. You know, if you think about Ruthless Rap Assassins talking about their parents kind of coming over. I've just come up from the Blue Plaque, and The Key, The Secret was about empowering yourself no matter your environment. And I think that it's the embracement of literature as well as their surroundings that maybe is what makes the music so special.
Wow, thank you.
I think one is the ways of immigration coming into the city. And so each wave comes into the city, brings its own culture in, mixes with the city, and it's very welcoming. It's more, nowhere it's perfect, of course, but all those kind of layers coming in and mixing together, that's dynamite. And, you know, when I just wrote the Oasis book, I mean, they were Irish Manx, you know, and that the Irish influence is huge right across the music scene. And I think a willingness to cross-pollinate is really important. I think by the time you get to the 70s and late 70s, it starts to become defined by its music culture. So everybody moves in here. And then it becomes, once you get a name for it, then it gets easy, doesn't it? Get the name for it, it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you would think like a big city, every big city would have decades and decades of musical culture. But most big cities, they have like a moment and nothing happens for 20 or 30 years. Whereas here, it never stops, does it? It just keeps coming and coming and coming. I think it's far enough away from London not to be influenced by London as well. I think that's really important. I feel a bit, you know, Birmingham, I think sometimes they're a bit stuck because they're too close to London, aren't they?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, if you're in Birmingham, you're only an hour from London, so you go do your thing there and come back. But here, you do it in Manchester, it becomes a very Manchester thing. And we don't, you don't want to say this, but it's kind of like the capital of the North, really, isn't it? Which causes a lot of problems, saying that, isn't it?
Even though it's true. So I'm going to now go to one of the two great forbidden dinner party conversations, which is politics. So for Lisa, Lisa and Andy, you know, both of you have, you know, Lisa, you've interviewed some of the key civic leaders, and Andy, you know, you've written about how city leaders have kind of capitalised on cultural momentum to regenerate Greater Manchester. So I want to talk about that for a minute, because it's actually quite rare for civic leaders and city leaders to really understand what's happening at a grassroots level in a city and capitalise that on that and really communicate that to get the city growing. So in the time that you've both, you know, seen that growth of Manchester, you know, have the city's rebels and rulers been telling the same story, or has there been a creative tension there that's helped the city grow? So I don't know, maybe Lisa, if I come to you first, I know you've done some interviews on this quite recently.
I think my point would be in that situation. So I think that we have, Andy might disagree, but I think in terms of the civic leadership of this city, whilst certainly I've had my career here, we had 25 years of Sir Howard Bernstein and Sir Richard Leese, and that was often been referred to as a benign dictatorship. But there's no doubt that they created massive momentum, which got us where we are today. And now I think they were very much about creating succession and young leaders.
Yeah.
And who we have now in our administration, Bev Craig Leader and our new CEO, Tom Stannard, they're leaders for now.
Yeah.
And they very much are present now. They are telling the story of the city. And, you know, I think we're in really good hands.
Yeah. Wonderful. Andy.
Yeah, the leaders and the rebels or the dissenting voices haven't always been on the same page, but... And my book goes into the 1998 fiasco of the launch of Manchester's brand, which created actually such a blowback from the likes of Tom Bloxham, Carol Ainscough, Nick Johnson, that it brought, it actually, that explosion set up a conversation which brought those people actually into the room where it happened and the decision-making corridors of power. And from that time, I mean, you know, Pat Carney, the city centre councillor, came to a meeting of creatives in the early 90s and said, we respect the creativity in this room, we want to work with you. So I think Manchester was far ahead of other cities, certainly outside London, in recognising the power of the creatives. And we go to the Hacienda, made worldwide headlines, Newsweek magazine in America, 4 million readers when magazines were a thing for younger people. We used to get information from, you know, bits of paper. These things had huge influence, and the city leaders woke up to the fact that they had this homegrown, authentic youth culture that gave us a standout from other cities.
Yeah,
I think one of the strengths is that the culture doesn't come from the top down, it comes from the bottom up. I think all the best fashion, pop culture ideas comes off the street. It's not dictated by who runs the city or the millionaires or the people at the top. They just, it's good that they allow it to happen and it's good that they recognise it happens. But the best stuff's done by a kid in Moss Side or a kid in Burnage, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the strength of Manchester, I think, because he's actually a very working class city and he's actually in touch with itself. And it doesn't really matter who runs the city, this stuff's going to happen anyway, isn't it?
See, Karen, if I can pick this one up with you, because actually, you know, you've made a career out of uncovering these hidden gems who've really transformed the city. And, you know, unsung, you know, musicians and migrant community heroes. I suppose, could you bring that to life? You know, is there one story, for example, recently that's really been on your mind of someone that's made a massive difference that probably we haven't heard of? And also, you know, what is the power of those stories? And I say that in the context of the fact that, you know, we all hear about the Hacienda and Tony Wilson and all this, but there's so many stories that made the city what it is.
I think the thing about Manchester is there are so many. People don't want to shout about their achievements here too much. There's a small section that do. So you repeatedly, there's people that you know repeatedly tell you something pioneering that they did. I mean, Alan Erasmus was just at the Blue Plaque opening installation. And how many people know who Alan Erasmus is? But it wasn't just Tony Wilson. There were three founders of Thatch Records, and one was a black man called Alan Erasmus. And when we were there, hardly anybody knew who he was. Nobody knows what he looks like. He said he's been cut out of pictures when they do TV documentaries. You know, and you know, that's one of the biggest stories in the world, and it's part of Manchester's foundation, isn't it? Thatch Records, everyone will agree. And, you know, I repeatedly speak to musicians who are the voices of records that have sold millions, have got impact worldwide, and it's not just one or two, there are many, many, I'd have to say. And someone was asked at an event I was at Jodrell Bank last week, why don't we know? And somebody said, no one ever asks. Absolutely. And I think that's key
really
thing.
Powerful. Yeah. And at least if I can come to you on this as well, because, you know, I remember when you launched the We Built the City podcast, and, you know, one of the things that I loved about that was, you know, there's that mixture of the kind of household names in the city that people know, but, you know, you've really fought hard to also just get those kind of inspiring stories on. And kind of what inspired you to start doing that, I guess? And what is it that you've learned, I guess, about Manchester from some of those stories?
I wanted to show my gratitude really to the city and the city region for having supported me and giving me a great childhood and a great career. And I wanted to explore the purpose and values and the legacy of Greater Mancunians, but born, bred and adopted, because as Tony Walsh said, you know, some are born here, some are drawn here. So, and it was literally about finding some of those stories that hadn't been told. So people that we do know lots about and then other people that we're perhaps not so familiar with.
Yeah. And I've got a question for Andy and John, actually, on music, because, you know, when I'm travelling to different places in the world, you know, and I go, you know, you're in a random taxi somewhere and you go from Manchester, and it's always two things. There's one football club which will either fill you with horror or dread,
two.
Depending on, I mean, this is a whole different debate. But people love, you know, wherever you are in the world, people love Manchester's music. And, you know, Andy, you know, you've chronicled that era of cultural explosion and the revival of the city. And John, you've spoken so eloquently in your books and on stage today, not just in your books, you know, about that music story. And I just wanted maybe to get from both of you kind of why did this arguably otherwise quite small city, let's say globally, become so iconic in music? Because we really, really outperform in music and culture.
Well, Go on.
I don't think it's that small as a city. You know, this is a little bugbear of mine that when you look it up on Wikipedia, the population of Manchester is 400,000 or something. It's Greater Manchester. That's 3 million people. That's a big size city, and there's a lot of people. And it's a lot of people come here and move here. People always moved here because of universities. They had the media here. Granada was here. It wasn't like a complete backwater, was it? In the 60s, it was a big music scene. But those people tended to move out of town. And what happened in the late 70s, people stayed here and they built something here. And I think that was important. The dream of any kid in a band in the 70s was to get the band signed to a label.
Absolutely.
And move to London. But in the late 70s onwards, people stayed here and they built something here. And that made a big difference. And when you got that here, then it's like you were saying, it's like you're born here and you're drawn here, aren't there? People came here. It's either London or Manchester for most people, small towns.
Yeah.
And Manchester was a much more open music scene as well. You know, it wasn't closed, and anybody could come and join into it as well. I think that's important. And yeah, there is talent here because, like I said before, ways of immigration, bringing ideas in, and a mixture of people in, and also in a smallish, it's a big, small city, isn't it? So everybody kind of knows everybody else. You know, it's funny because there's a guy I speak to here from Stoke, which is smaller than Manchester. And we were saying, do you know that guy? And they go, no. And we go, but how come you don't know each other? But here, everybody sort of knows everyone else. You might not have met them, but you've seen them around. And if you haven't met them, you just go up and say, you just start chatting. And that's a very northern thing. In London, if you start chatting to a stranger, they arrest you, wouldn't they?
I mean, just to underline John's point about staying in Manchester, you know, Factory Records and most of the people in the music business up here have always been Mancunian exceptionalists. They think this city's the best city in the world, and they don't want to leave it. And what did the Beatles do? They went to London. What did Motown do? It left Detroit for LA. What did the Factory Records directors do? They put their money into the Hacienda, and lost 18 million quid of their money, and mainly probably Joy Division, New Order money. But it's all about that, F off London, we're staying here, and they can come to us if they're interested. And that there is that attitude that still, I think, runs strong.
Yeah. And it's become a self-fulfilling prophecy now, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, just speak to me, doing a fashion thing in here, actually, in September. We talk about that, you know, the fashion thing is, it's not represented well enough here yet. It's going to happen, isn't it? But the fashion thing is very much run in London. It's like you have to wait for London's permission to do it. That just seems, in music, that'd be laughable. You wouldn't wait for someone in London to give you a pat on the head to make a piece of music, you know? So why not in all fields, you know?
See, Karen, I'd love maybe just to bring you in on this as well, because I know, you know, when we were just sat having a coffee before, and you were talking about that remarkable story of the queen of rock and roll.
Oh, yes. So... Sister Rosetta Tharpe, the godmother of rock and roll, played here in Manchester. She played on the blues train that went from where Grand Central is, the old GMX, and the train went right through to the disused Charlton Station, which is in Whalley Range. And many people think that it was Manchester, Tennessee that it was filmed in. They don't actually think that it was Manchester, the UK. But I just find it alarming that the woman who invented rock and roll, the distortion on the guitar that brought gospel music into concert halls, isn't recognised by this city. And it's I think it's the biggest story that Manchester's sitting on that they just haven't celebrated.
Yeah. Wow.
There was a radio documentary on her last year, which I was on, actually.
I wasn't on that. But I'm campaigning for a plaque, so I'm just saying.
It's on YouTube, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And Andy, you know, earlier in your career, in chapter one of your career, in fact, from our discussion before, so Andy's had multiple lives, is a bit like a cat. I think he's currently on life three. So life one was journalist, life two was entrepreneur, and now author and influencer. So if we go to life one...
Influencer, Andy.
It completely is influencer. Yes.
Well, it didn't exist then. But
yeah, exactly.
What's
it's all new. But was there a moment, you know, when you were publishing City Life and you were kind of, you know, really embedded as a journalist in Manchester? You know, it's great to look back and go, oh yes, of course, that was really important. But when you were in the thick of it, was there a moment where you thought, actually, this is really the start of something big? Did you ever get a feel of that?
I think two of those moments. One, Commonwealth Games was a worldwide, you know, massive rock in the pool, sending out ripples of profile about Manchester. The other one, much more on the music tip, I was with him and another journalist, Harry Stafford, you may not even remember, 1987, May 1987 in the Hacienda.
Yeah.
We were probably 26, 27, and there were all these 16-year-olds going completely mental, in a swimming pool, and on the dance floor, they put a swimming pool in the Hacienda. Yeah. And we said to ourselves, there's something going on here, because they were like, it was 1,200 teenagers going wild. Of course, there was something going on that was also illegal drugs, but, you know, that was part of it. And that scene became Manchester a couple of years later.
Was that something that you resonated with in that era? Because I always wonder if there's that moment, you know, you see it in business sometimes where there's a particular company or moment where everyone goes, oh yeah, everything's changed now.
Yeah, I mean, that was a key moment, actually, what Andrew was saying there, when the Hacienda, which was amazing, the idea of building the Hacienda in the first place, but the moments when the kids, about 4, 5, 6 years later, invaded it and took it over. Again, it came off the streets. That was not dictated by anybody from the top. It was just like a space that they took over and created their own culture in it. It's all the best movements come from, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and what I wanted to do, because, you know, all podcasts like a bit of future gazing. So I thought, you know, you've all been embedded in this city long enough to sort of really get a sense of what's happening. You know, all these factoids are pretty well known in this room today, but for the listeners as well, you know, industrial revolution here, you know, we've got lots of AI and creative and media work, all sorts of things happening. And, you know, we're right here in a place that's going to become, you know, the real entrepreneurial hub of the city. But I do wonder what that next story will be, because if I think about my life, you know, I just clipped the Hacienda era. I'm sufficiently young to have just clipped it. I just clipped the Hacienda era. So I sort of missed that. And so I wonder, what do you think the next stories are from what's happening in the city now? What do you think the next stories are that people are going to tell about this city? So I don't know, Lisa, we'll start with you and then work our way down our panel.
Yeah, well, when I left university, my parents were absolutely devastated because I got a job in advertising in London. And I went down and there were no flat vowels in London back then and everyone was smoking Marlboro menthols. And I thought, that's not for me. I'm from
Salford. Was it like Mad Men? Was it literally like Mad Men?
It was absolutely not for me at all. So yeah. I came back up and got a job on Salford Crescent for £5,000 a year. And back then, you know, all the buildings were black. You know, it if anybody here looked back at Manchester then, they would have thought it was crap. But it was like, oh, yeah. Crap. It was all, it was amazing and we loved it. But for me, you know, what I really think now, and City Council has just recently launched their Our Manchester strategy, which is our ambition for the city for 10 years. Yeah. And that's all around people. It's people first. So I'm hoping that, you know, the stories that we can be telling, say, in the next 10 years is about that we have lots and lots of opportunity here. We're every single global list going. I think Time Out today, we're, you know, UK's most livable city. You know, it's about opportunities for everybody. And Tom Stannard now, the new CEO, said that those opportunities shouldn't trickle down. Yeah. They should be dispersed equally. So that's what I'm hoping the story will be.
Okay, thank you.
They should flood down, not trickle
flood
down.
Yeah.
Andy?
I'm a writer, so I'm a reader. I'm awaiting the great Manchester novel, I think.
That's a good point.
Not yet been done, the modern Manchester. And probably a Netflix series that come out of it to be produced at Versa Studios, no doubt.
Yeah. Is that the one you're writing now?
I haven't got the talent or imagination to write
novels. Storms is publishing one. There's a Manchester...
Which one?
There's a Manchester TV producer who's writing one called Wimmy Road, about Wimslow Road.
Oh, that's amazing.
I interviewed him.
I'll just feel maybe hungry the whole way through. John?
I think the ambition is good. The idea, I like the idea of Manchester. I always say Manchester, when he faces up to the alpha cities, the big cities like London, it's like a little dog and a big dog. You know, but dogs have no idea the size of another dog.
Yes.
It's like a chihuahua that's not scared of an Alsatian, isn't it? It doesn't look down, it doesn't compete with London. It actually thinks it's above London. And that sense of ambition, that will accelerate. But it should not let, but it should bring all the people with it as well. You know, I think it shouldn't be scared of becoming a bigger city because, you know, constantly people complain about new stuff, don't they? They go, well, there's too many arenas, too many this, too many that. But in our heads, we should say, well, why not? You know, we're big enough to have all that. As long as it doesn't lock everybody out, that's a problem, isn't it? But I know that's a lot easier to say than do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Karen?
I think the way Manchester's developing, it's providing an amazing backdrop for films and entertainment. But what I do think, if it provided more spaces for entertainers and creatives, I think that would be the next story, because I think it's hard for people to rehearse and create in the spaces like they were able to before. Those spaces are disappearing. But if they had more spaces like this that had that space to allow practice, I think then that we would wipe the floor with the rest of the country. That's my opinion.
It might be worth adding that there is a space. The Sir Bob Scott Studios have opened next to home, which is for, you know, like drama and performance companies. And Sir Bob Scott was the guy who basically was a bit ignored. I know he was...
He wanted the Olympics.
He was knighted, but he had the he made the Olympic bids and the Commonwealth Games bids happen. And opened the Corner House, the Palace Theatre, the Opera House, and the Royal Exchange. And he's still not free. He's alive. He's not given the freedom of the city.
Yeah. So there's one thing that's kind of occurred to me with this as well, because when you talk about spaces, I think one of the things that I've really observed about Manchester, probably more than any other city, is the power of asking. You know, if you are, you know, let's say an emerging food and beverage brand, or you're a theatre group, or, you know, if you need space and you need place to do something, you know, Manchester's business community and, you know, we're very gracious to be here with Mike Ingall and the new space that he's created here. But, you know, people are very generous with giving space and opportunities to people in the city, which you don't really see many other places. Is that something that you've experienced? Because it feels like you're not going to kickstart culture, you're not going to kickstart early stage businesses unless you have that generosity from the people that have the central spaces. I don't know, Lisa, you're nodding away, and then John.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. And we refer to it as the Manchester Bank account. Basically, you've got to put in more than you take out, and I think that's what people do here. And we say that, you know, if you... This is what I noticed in times of crisis in Manchester, that those people who add value are remembered and the people who don't add value are remembered. So if, as long as you put more in than you can take out, you can make the ask. And I think that's what we're good at, is helping people out when they've got an opportunity or when they need real help.
Absolutely.
I think there's never enough space, is there? I think all creative stuff and all ideas come out of space. And I guess now the city centre, because it is really full, where is this space going to be, isn't it? You know, this, we have to think about these things, like you were saying a minute ago as well. And I think, I mean, it's not totally squashed out, but it's just, I mean, all the rehearsal space or the space where you can make a noise is about 3 miles out of the city centre and not in the city centre anymore, which does make a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's about cost. I mean, the price of entry for doing something creative in the centre is now completely out of scale to how it was in the 80s and 90s, where, you know, you could hire a place for nothing as long as you filled a venue with a small crowd. I believe now the asking price is 8,000 deposit, which I know from personal experience, having tried to get events going. That's not good.
Yeah.
Because the price it's just rethinking
the model, though, isn't it? It doesn't have to be, nothing ever has to be as it is, does it?
Yeah. Is that something that you've seen with your work in arts and creative as well, Karen?
I mean, the one thing, I know we champion Manchester, but I find that when you ask for spaces in London, people are more giving than here.
Really?
As a creative, yeah. I mean, in the last 2 months, I have had some amazing offers about spaces, but, you know, like in London, a restaurant will say, we're shut for 4 hours, you can come in then. Though they're kind of more flexible and they really appreciate profiling creatives. I find it's less so here. It has been in the last 5 years. It's difficult. We, as a creator and a producer, we have to go to London and then come back home.
Yeah, which is a shame, really. Especially because it's about £1,000 to go on the train now, which is ridiculous. And the Wi-Fi doesn't work and there's no mobile signal, as we found out trying to hold a phone call just 2 days ago. I want to come to a personal story question to close in a moment, but before we get to that, you know, I know, for example, Karen, you've really championed this around the unsung and unheard voices, but I want to get some advice from all of you for the people in this room, because, you know, we're in a technology era now, so oftentimes the most connected or the loudest voice can be the one that people hear the most. So I guess it's a two-parter, so take either part that you want to. You know, A, if you're in this room and you're wanting to kind of elevate your voice in a city like Manchester, if you want to get to that right table, if you want to make those connections, how do you do it? Because, you know, it's a question that I get asked sometimes, which is, where do you start? Or, if you don't want to tackle that one, how do we make sure that we don't miss those unsung voices in the city? So, whoever wants to go first, and we'll make sure we get some advice from all of you for our...
Well, I think it's something that's bad in modern times, that people don't listen anymore. People talk over each other. So it's a very internet thing, isn't it? I mean, the internet's great for a lot of reasons, but when people stop listening to other people, then we've got a real problem. And you can see that politically around the world. But surely a city like this, a city that was defined by revolution, you know, by all the revolutionary things that happened, you know, from Peterloo onwards in the 19th century, we should hold on to those revolutionary community kind of ideas. That's our strength, isn't it? We don't want to end up being just another a cheap version of London. We have to redefine what a modern city is. And that's part, to me, of what the future struggle is in a lot of fields, isn't it? And maybe culture is good for that, because culture is the glue that holds together a city, isn't it?
Exactly. So, Karen, if you want to go next.
I think that people have to continue to create community and new tribes, and I think that spaces like this will allow people to connect. I think that's the one reason why sometimes people dip under the radar. They kind of become quite reclusive and don't kind of come together in these spaces, and I think that we need more of that.
Absolutely. Andy.
Yeah, because we used to be able to build scenes through word of mouth, and now with screens, it's, you know, word of screen, isn't it? And we're all you know, swamped, really, with a kind of tsunami of information and every day, so it is hard for, if you like, new things, new people. I think if they can add value by finding partnerships, alliances, this is good for me, this is good for you because it's mutual. Those kind of things help build a critical mass momentum. But, you know, it's hard because we're all, you know, we've got too many flat platforms to look at.
Absolutely. Lisa?
I agree with Andy. I think I often say Manchester, it's not who you know, it's who knows you.
Yeah.
And that they normally know you because you've added value. So I think everyone, if you add value, you can, you know, you can get there. But also, if you have a platform, I think it's our duty to make space for other people who do not.
And I think this is where spaces like this are really useful, because, you know, there's a tendency now to kind of, you know, work from home behind our screens. But a space like this at Canfield, you know, there's co-working, there's residents, there's small businesses, there's big businesses, there's artists. And, you know, even for me personally, being in a space like this, you just don't know who you're going to meet. And that chance conversation over a coffee, that leads to something. So I think it's really important to be part of places like this. But I wanted to get some personal anecdotes from you, because there is something unique about culture here. You know, I know when my dad came to Manchester in 1968, you know, he was struggling to find somewhere to live, because a lot of landlords were like, oh, we, you know, it's not for you, or we don't necessarily want someone like you here. And then actually the Jewish community adopted him, and he lived above a pizza shop near Cheetham Hill for a while before he sort of found his feet. And that was Manchester. But I wonder, for each of you, is there a personal anecdote like that? Something that just sums up for you, you know, why Manchester special? Was it a moment you witnessed, a concert, an interview, a neighbourhood memory, just something which for you really sums up what it is about this place? I know, Lisa, we'll start with you and then make sure everyone has a chance to share.
For me, it was the day after the arena bomb, in May 23rd, 2017. And there was the vigil in front of the town hall.
Yeah.
And it was a moment that we shared in our grief and our pain. And I remember that obviously lots of film crews had been flown in from around the world, and they were wandering around in the crowd trying to put microphones in people's faces and ask Mancunians how they felt. And it was really interesting to see how few Mancunians would engage.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to spend that time together.
Wow. Andy?
My story is actually set in this street in 1981. I was a new student. I went to see a football match at Old Trafford, and I ended up being chased by a mob around Castlefield, which doesn't look like Castlefield now, because it was full of rotting.
Was it still a Roman fort
pubs
then?
There were no street lights.
Yeah.
It's like the Warriors movie.
Wow.
And as we got past the Deansgate pub, the landlord saw what was going on. He said, in here, gave me a tot of whiskey. And that was one of my introductions to Manchester.
Fantastic.
An unexpected history lesson, some unexpected exercise, and some warm
like
Mancunian
that.
Hospitality.
John.
You could pop over the road and pay for it now.
Exactly. Well, exactly.
He'd left that now.
Yeah.
I don't really have one specific one. I think every day something happens. You know, every day you go out, I'm out in the town centre, every day bumping into people. They're just like lots of micro stories. I think in a sense, it's probably better like that. There's not one defining story. There's just millions and millions of small stories. You know, every time you go out, someone gives you a little piece of music, listen to this, someone talks about something, a little spark of energy, a little idea. You say, why don't you meet that person? Why don't you go and do that? Somebody says that back to you. And I think that probably sums up how the city works, in a sense,
absolutely,
more than anything. Yeah.
Karen, what about for you?
Mine is of my granddad, actually, who I realised much later was the first, like, black grocer. But as a kid, he came from Jamaica. He came in the war first, and then he went back and he came from Jamaica, and he was a baker. And when he set up his grocers on Upper Brook Street, as a Jamaican, he must have thought, how can I ingratiate myself here? But he thought about the kids first. So he'd sell hard dough bread, which is Jamaican bread, to the Caribbeans. But he made homemade Vimto ice lollies for the kids. And it's so funny that so many people kind of like remember that. But it's just that thing about embracing Manchester as well. You know, like somebody embracing the spirit of Manchester. Why would you pick like Vimto? But it was something that, you know, all the kids wanted. And it's very Manchester Vimto, isn't it?
You should start that again.
I know.
There's an opportunity there.
I think we should start a petition to restart these, to restart that. I think for me, if I can just share one before we wrap up. I remember it was kind of pre-pandemic, and I was walking down Deansgate, and somebody shouted the classic racist slur at me from across the road of, go home, you beep. And so I crossed the road and had a chat with them. And I don't think there's any other city where I'd feel safe doing that. But I crossed the road and I said, like, do I know you? You know, are you a disgruntled former employee? What have I done? And we just had a really open chat about the fact that he was second generation jobless from North Manchester, and he felt that the immigrant community had come and taken the jobs from him, and he just felt really angry. And we actually had a dialogue, and probably wouldn't end up being best friends, but we probably left that conversation, both of us feeling a little less animosity. And I don't think there's many other cities where you can enable that kind of conversation. But that draws us to a closer. Thank you so much for listening to Foundations, a celebration of bold beginnings, brave ideas, and the people who make them possible. So if you like what you've heard today, please remember to subscribe to Foundations on wherever you get your podcasts and follow at Camfield MCR on Instagram and LinkedIn for more information on future episodes and the great events we're having here at Campfield. But also just a massive thank you to my excellent panel today for their insights and stories. Thank you.
You've been listening to Foundations, a celebration of bold beginnings, brave ideas, and the people who make them possible. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts for the latest episodes and follow at Campfield MCR on Instagram.